Well, folks, I don't know about you, but we've been told repeatedly that we are under ceasefire conditions in the Middle East. And as I look back in the previous 5 days and see who is shooting what at whom, I'm beginning to wonder whether or not we're just not paying attention. And here to talk to us about it is Aaron David Miller, former State Department Middle East analyst and negotiator in both Republican and Democratic administrations. He's the senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be here with you.
Aaron, I'm not sure what we're in, but there's a lot of firepower going back and forth across the boundaries of these countries.
No, there is. You got two events here. You got the Israeli-Hezbollah conflict, which President Trump has at least temporarily put back in the box, although I suspect you're going to see a wash, rinse, and repeat cycle if we can't make progress in the other big conflict, which is the main event. And that is the war that the president launched on February 28th. You have a ceasefire on April 7th/8th. There's been some interruptions of those ceasefire, but nothing like a return to the major war. So the question becomes whether the Lebanon problem is going to explode, which will then sort of morph over to the other conflict and will push the Iranians and the Americans back into conflict. And the question there becomes, can you reach an agreement between Iran on one hand and the Trump administration on the other? And we're now in the fourth month of this war. Ceasefires are made to be broken. I'm frankly surprised that the Iranian-U.S. conflict hasn't gone back to a much more intense confrontation. So there's some hope, but the gaps on the big issues, right, are really, you know, Grand Canyon-like in their size. President wants the Straits of Hormuz open. The Iranians can close them anytime they want. The Iranians want the naval blockade that Trump administration imposed eased. So there is a deal there. It's just it's very difficult to get to because there's less than zero trust and confidence between Washington and this brutal repressive authoritarian regime in Tehran.
You have been in the role of negotiator, right? I mean, so what does it say to you? What does it forecast to you with the overt aggressiveness that the Iranians have in salvaging or saving Hezbollah? We know that it's been nothing but a proxy for them, a terrorist proxy for them that, you know, and even in the midst of this ceasefire, Hezbollah has fired over 2,000 rockets into northern Israel.
it's a really good question. It's their billion-dollar proxy, and yeah, it is a proxy. They do control it. You have Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders on the ground in Beirut. The Lebanese wanted to get rid of the Iranian ambassador. He's still there. So Iran exercises firm control, and it is an asset they're not prepared to give up. And unfortunately for the Israelis, their massive campaign, you remember, September 2024, exploding walkie-talkies, exploding pagers, mm-hmm. the killing of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, the Israelis believed that they had hollowed it out. But Hezbollah, like Hamas, Gaza, they face somewhat of a similar problem, although Hamas's capacity to strike Israel is not nearly as lethal as Hezbollah's. You can't get rid of these non-state actors through military means alone. The Brits ran into this problem in Northern Ireland. The only way to do it was somehow to incorporate the IRA and the Protestant paramilitaries in some sort of political solution. But nobody's talking about basically including Hezbollah as part of some sort of peace settlement. So no, this is I'm a rock and roll fan. This is Hotel California and the Eagles. You can check out any time you want, but you can never leave. And that's the real problem, I think, for Americans, the administration. I work for Republicans and Democrats. I voted for Republicans and Democrats. More often than not, the Middle East is a place where U.S. ideas on peacemaking and war making go to die. It's not a happy place. And we got to be very, very careful. Iraq, Afghanistan's a cautionary tale, as is this war launched on February 28th. Is an example of when a great power ends up wrestling with smaller ones whose stakes are existential. That means Hezbollah, it's about Hezbollah's existence, Iran's about Iran's existence, and Israel. It's about Israel's existence, too. When the stakes are existential, the great powers, no matter how great they think they are, they don't have a greater stake in doing, surviving, manipulating, maneuvering than the folks who live in the neighborhood. And we forget that in this region, and we can't.
It seems as though the ebb and flow of diplomatic relations here have been very tenuous. And I was reading a comment that President Trump made to the Financial Times the other day in terms of Benjamin Netanyahu. And he says, I call all the shots. He doesn't call the shots. I find this kind of rhetoric now that's going on. There's an underbelly to what's happening in our relationship with Israel right now, where, you know, Netanyahu even came out the other day and said, yeah, I support that we stop getting arms from you guys. I mean, we have to do it in phases, but I'm in complete support of that. And yeah. I think everybody is trying to telegraph to the other one, we're going to do what we need to do for our salvation, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an accurate analysis, Newell. It's just that President Trump has enormous leverage over Benjamin Netanyahu.
Oh,
and it really has nothing to do with the conflict. It has to do with the fact that this prime minister, the longest governing prime minister in the history of the state of Israel, has governed the country 15 of the last 17 years, is on trial for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust in the Jerusalem District Court 3 years and running. Netanyahu must remain in power. And Donald Trump is more popular in Israel than he is. And elections are coming October. They have to be held by October 27th. Netanyahu needs Donald Trump, not as a passive campaigner. Netanyahu needs Trump to set up an election central headquarters in Washington and run a reelect Benjamin Netanyahu campaign. He cannot afford an open break with the president. That's not to say that the president can remote control him, but the president can bigfoot him. And if the president gets close to actually getting an agreement with the Iranians, and the Iranians say to him, look, we need a real ceasefire in Lebanon, not a phony ceasefire. We need the Israelis to stand down. And Trump persuades himself that this is his way out of the box that he's put himself into. He'll call Netanyahu and he'll say, look, my friend, we've done a lot for you, and I need you to stand down. And under those circumstances, Netanyahu doesn't have much of a choice. He will stand down. But we're not there yet, which gives Netanyahu a fair amount of leverage still with the president. So these are two adept politicians, both who are somehow skilled in the art of the con. And the reality is, Trump has a lot more leverage over Netanyahu than vice versa.
So how does this play out? We have midterms coming up at the same time as they have to have an election, which seem, you know, the Iranians look at our midterms as kind of a weak point for the Trump administration, right? And I would assume they probably think it's also a weak point for Netanyahu as well. And I also assume that they're going to try to do everything that they can to exploit these weak points and leverage them. So my question to you is, what does that look like from the Iranian perspective? What would you anticipate that they do to exploit these two weak spots that each of their formidable adversaries have?
Yeah, it's a very good point. They think time's on their side. They're losing $500 million a day because of the naval blockade. 90% of their imports are seaborne. So there's no doubt they're hurting. But I come back to my point. The guys running this country, the guys that control the guns, the money, the oil, and the potential nuclear infrastructure, for these guys, this is not just a foreign policy issue. This is not, they don't have elections. They don't have to worry about that. But this is an existential issue for them. So they think time's on their side. They think they have the capacity to escalate. And they're reading Trump right here to a degree when they conclude, you know, this guy really doesn't want to go back to military conflict. And I think that's an accurate assessment. That said, Donald Trump's problem is he's got to figure out a way to spin a win out of this. And right now, there are only two ways to do that. You reopen the straits without paying for it, which is going to be hard to do. Or number two, you get some move by the Iranians that constrains or restrains their nuclear infrastructure. And that's going to require weeks, Newell, if not longer, of negotiations. So I'm telling you, I on this one, you know, I'm not even going to take a flyer and make a prediction here. It's just too uncertain. There are too many moving parts. I just got to say, this is a cautionary tale. If you launch a war of choice that isn't based on an imminent or critical threat, you really need to make sure that you've calibrated the means at your disposal to accomplish the ends that you really want. You got to make sure you don't overestimate your own strengths, and you got to make doubly sure you don't underestimate the strengths of your adversary. And this is a real problem.
You know what I found interesting, and of course, I don't know one tenth or 1% of what y'all know about all this. But as I just kind of apply common sense principles to a lot of this, if there can be, I have yet to figure out why the Iranians are want to go throw missiles at the Kuwaitis, at UAE, at you know, Bahrain and Qatar, and you know, I mean, I'm just like, why are they doing that? Do they believe that those parties are going to end up putting pressure on Trump as well?
Yep, I think that's part of their calculation. Look, I have no brief for this brutal, repressive, authoritarian regime that murders, tortures, and imprisons its own citizens. But the Israelis and the Americans launched this war on February 28th. And the Iranians are no match for the Israeli Defense Forces or the U.S. military. So what did they do? They escalated horizontally, not vertically. They escalated horizontally. They launched a few drones, which told every insurance company that it's laying out money to insure shipping companies that it's no longer safe to passage through the Straits of Hormuz, which is 20% of the world's global daily oil supply. And instead of directing most of their ballistic missile fire at the Israelis, they turned on a target much closer to home. So they've weaponized their geography, and they've been incredibly successful. Because these two cards, their ability to basically make life miserable for the oil producers on one hand, and to essentially block the Straits of Hormuz and to hold the entire international economy hostage, we're not feeling it perhaps as bad as those countries in Asia are feeling it. I mean, gas in California is probably, I don't know what it is in New Orleans. By the way, I had a year and a half at Tulane. It was one of the most memorable experiences of my young life. I love New Orleans. It's phenomenal, phenomenal city, phenomenal people. It was just, sorry for the non sequitur, but I just wanted to get that in. So I really do think that, you know, Iran's capitalized on their own weakness to basically turn it around. And they've succeeded. I hate to say it, but they're succeeding. They're suffering as well. They're succeeding.
You know, what's interesting, too, is everybody, yourself included, is saying time. They believe that time is on their side. We know that they keep elongating this thing. I got to imagine we realize that we get weaker as this thing goes along, right? I mean, it
yeah, I mean, we're look,
the American,
we're
the
our,
American
our
public is free falling on this issue right now.
Yep.
I mean, it's
not to mention the fact that every time we launch a Tomahawk missile or a THAAD or a Patriot interceptor, we're talking in the millions. The Iranians are doing this with against the Gulf and the Straits with $20,000 drones, and they're doing it effectively. So I don't know. You know, again, I work for Republicans and Democrats. I voted for Republicans and Democrats. I think when we're looking at this region, we really got to be smart. And I think the president looked at Venezuela and grab and go of Maduro and his wife and the extraordinary performance of the U.S. military in this special operations. And he figured, you know, I'll find an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez that I can cut a deal with. And the Iranians will never be able to close the straits because the U.S. military is just too powerful. But as my colleague at Carnegie, Karim Sedjapour, says, Trump didn't find an Iranian Delcy Rodriguez in Tehran. He found an Iranian Kim Jong-un from North Korea. And that's yeah. part of the problem. And now we got to live with this. And it's not pretty. I think it's hard to imagine now how you get a win out of this, a win for America out of this. It really is.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be placing conditions on all the players as to, you know, a touching. You're either all, I don't know, you're either all in or you're not. And, you know, and trying to find that exit ramp is sometimes that exit ramp is very elusive. I think you would agree.
I would.
It's not right now. It doesn't seem readily apparent. I just
no,
keep looking for it, but I can't find it.
No, yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed the conversation, your insight, and thank you for the time. Aaron David Miller, former State Department. Middle East analyst and negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. He's also a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Okunar Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us.